Welcome to Whitley on Wine with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist Robert Whitley.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be jewelry. Either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape.
Welcome, and I'm really looking forward to today's show, and I'll tell you why. Patson Hall Winery has been around actually for something like 20 years, but I've recently, I won't say discovered them, but sort of rediscovered Patson Hall. And today, joining me by telephone from Northern California is James Hall, the winemaker at Patson Hall. And it is a great pleasure to have you, James. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Rob.
You know, I don't know how you flew for so long under my radar. I knew about the wines. You know, you make vineyard-designated wines. I knew the whole story. You were at Flora Springs at one time, and that's one of my favorite wineries in the Napa Valley. But it just seems like lately, the wines that I've tasted from Patson Hall have just soared. And you're to be complimented, but also I'm just thrilled to be able to have you on the show.
Oh, well, thanks ever so much.
Now, tell me a little bit about your background and how you were working at Flora Springs, how your company came together, mm-hmm. and the vision for Patson Hall, what Patson Hall is today.
Well, my first vintage was 1981. I grew up in the Santa Cruz area, and Santa Cruz has quite a few wineries. And I got interested in it really as a freshman in college. You know, a lot of people go off to school and discover all sorts of new things. Well, I discovered wine.
Yeah, some go to college and discover beer.
Well, I did a little bit of that as well. And I also happened to be working at a very posh French restaurant to help pay my college tuition and got exposed to some really wonderful wines, Grand Cru Burgundies and vintage champagnes. Mm-hmm. And that piqued my interest. And so I ended up changing degrees. I went from UC Santa Cruz to UC Davis and got into the fermentation science program. So really it started when I was 22 years old, deciding that I no longer wanted to be an anthropologist and moved to UC Davis to study winemaking. And that's how I got the job at Flora Springs in Napa Valley. I had some Davis experience and had a couple of crushes under my belt, and they needed an assistant winemaker, and there I was, ready to go.
Now, what did you do? You were the assistant winemaker, right?
That's right, yes. Ken Dice was the winemaker.
Right.
He started there in 1980.
And, you know, they were known for their Red Meritage wine. They were known for their Cabernets.
Yes.
And they became known, well known for their Chardonnay. But basically, you're working in the Napa Valley. You're thinking Cabernet. You're thinking, you know, Cabernet, Merlot, Meritage, that sort of mm-hmm. thing. But that's not what Patson Hall does.
No, we started with Chardonnay, and for several reasons. One, we thought that Chardonnay was being underserved. There were most of the producers were, as you say, Cabernet-focused, and they seemed to treat Chardonnay as sort of a cash flow white, something that they did on the side that typically wasn't planted in their best soils, that was more or less, you know, a white wine they had to have to serve in the beginning of their winemaker dinners. And so we saw an opportunity to go back to the Burgundian model, to look for sites that had cool weather, high acidity that allowed for the traditional Burgundian treatment of full malolactic and mm-hmm. bottling unfiltered. And so, frankly, it was just, you know, the four of us partners with, you know, almost no money, a strong will to make wine, and looking for a little niche that we could get involved in.
You know, when you were at Flora Springs and you started that program with the barrel-fermented Chardonnay, there weren't a lot of barrel-fermented Chardonnays around then, were there?
No, it was considered fairly revolutionary. Joe Heitz had aged some wine in oak, and of course, Montelena and Gergich had done, you know, some partial barrel fermentations and such. But Ken has he's married to a French woman, so he has a very strong French bent to his winemaking.
Mm-hmm.
And
great guy, by the way.
Oh, he's fantastic. He was my mentor. I've learned.
And he's a big fan of yours.
I learned more working for 5 years with him than I did in all my years at Davis, I got to say. But really, it was his desire to make wines in a traditional European way. And so, you know, part of my charge was to work with the barrels. I was really more of a cellar guy. The company was so small that it's not like I was any sort of management. Even though they gave me the title of assistant winemaker, I was really head barrel jockey.
Yeah.
And so the barrel fermentation process was something that I just, you know, learned from the ground up. And smelling the wines during the fermentation and figuring out which ones were going through malolactic and how the surly aging worked was really, you know, just all wonderful experience.
Was it a challenge to convince everyone that it was worth the expense, because barrels cost a lot of money, to use barrels for your Chardonnay program?
Well, it was. They weren't as expensive then as they are now, that's for sure.
No, and the dollar was strong, and there was no euro back then.
It's true. It was francs. And, you know, it was still a very big expense, but there was a movement to create more complex wines. And the food craze was all about high acidity and very lean structured wines that, you know, frankly were not as deeply textured and flavored as they could be. And the barrel fermentation techniques really added another layer to that. Obviously, it's, you know, how great Burgundy is made. And so people were traveling to Europe and coming back saying, hey, you know, let's try this stuff. And the wines really were better. So it wasn't really just an economic decision. It was a side-by-side trial and saying, wow, that's a lot better. We got to spend the money to do it.
So when you guys broke out on your own, you said that you didn't have a lot of money. How do you start a winery without money?
Well,
I think everyone wants to know the secret to that.
We started with $5,000. And the original intention was this was going to be our little weekend project, that we would stay working for other companies, and this would be our chance to sort of work out some winemaking, you know, ideas and get our toe in the pool of marketing and sales and really keep it as a weekend project.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people don't get that part of the equation, that it's one thing to make the wine, then somebody has to go out and sell it.
Well, that's where the partnership really excelled, because Donald had a lot of experience doing sales and marketing, and of course I had a lot of experience, well, not so much then, but you know, I was the cellar guy. I knew how to ferment the wine. And so it was a very blessed partnership from the beginning, but the financial side of it was the scary part. We were really completely unprepared for the financial end of it. And in fact, we ran the business out of a cigar box for the first 5 years. It was literally a very primitive, back of the envelope kind of operation. And it really started with the fact that our first vineyard owner gave us a break on some grapes.
You know, and we're going to talk about that when we come back. We're going to have to take a little bit of a break now, James. But when we come back, we'll talk about your relationships with the growers, because that really is the core of what Pats and Hall does, these single vineyard wines. So we will discuss that with James Hall of Pats and Hall Winery when Whitley on Wine continues.
Amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape.
Sign On Radio, 866-818-6384.
Peel me a grape.
And now, back to Whitley on Wine.
Slowly.
With your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist, Robert Whitley.
Okay, we're back, and we're chatting with James Hall, the winemaker and one of the founders of Pats and Hall Winery. And as I said before we went in the break in the previous segment, the core of Pats and Hall is the Vineyard Designate program. And Pats and Hall works with a number of the greatest vineyards, Hyde Vineyard, Chenoweth, Pasoni down in Monterey County, that we have here in California, and some of the top names. And I'm wondering, James, when you first set out with Pats and Hall, was it your vision then to do vineyard designated Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs, or was that something that evolved?
Single vineyard Chardonnay. We saw a lot of Napa wineries taking sort of the palette of flavors approach, where they would have a vineyard that was in a cool area and they'd use that for the acid backbone, and another vineyard that would be a little fruitier, and they'd blend to try to create these sort of winemaker type wines. And really, after traveling in Burgundy, we had an entirely different approach, which was to find vineyards that were complete in themselves and then focus on the best section of those vineyards and try to optimize the character of an individual site as opposed to making some sort of construction. And so it was really that was our, point in the whole exercise, was to try to show that there were great Chardonnay vineyards in California.
So when you first started, you didn't have a lot of money, but you knew some top growers. So who were some of the people who kind of helped you get off the ground?
Well, John Caldwell was very helpful. He was the exclusive grape supplier for Pallmeyer at the time, and he had some Chardonnay that Pallmeyer couldn't use, since Pallmeyer was focusing more on his red wines.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, hey, I like what you guys are doing. Let's do a deal. So we asked for 4 tons of Chardonnay. Well, it was a relatively large crop in 1988, and another buyer that he had backed out of a contract, and he was left with extra fruit. He came to us and said, hey, I'd love to sell you the grapes. And we said, well, that would be wonderful, but we don't have any money. In fact, we're kind of wondering how we're going to pay you for the tons we've already agreed to buy.
Right.
And he said, tell you what, I'll give you the fruit. You pay me when you sell the wine, and if it's good, we'll do a deal. And if you don't like it, well, we'll sell the wine in bulk, and you pay me what you get for it. So at that point, we then had to come up with the money for the barrels. So in a panic, I called my dad and said, hey, Dad, I need to buy some French oak barrels. And he said, well, what's French oak? And so I had to explain all that to him, and we cut a deal where I paid him what seemed like an exorbitant interest rate at the time. I don't think he was really convinced that this thing was going to work out. And so we borrowed some money from my dad to buy barrels, and, by God, we crushed the grapes and barrel fermented it, and the stuff was terrific.
Well, I know barrels run $600-$700, French barrels run $600-$700 a piece now. What were they back then?
Like
about $250, $300?
Almost $1,000.
Yeah, with a euro,
yeah,
as strong as it is, I'm sure, yeah. But back then, it was probably, about $300-$400?
Yes, right.
Yeah.
I seem to remember about $375,
mm-hmm.
which, back in the days when, my starting salary was $18,000 a year, so it seemed like an awful lot of money.
And we should tell people that you can get about 25 cases of wine out
right.
of a barrel. So to make 1,000 cases of wine, you need quite a few barrels.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is one of the most expensive elements in making wine, for sure.
Right.
Right there behind the grapes.
Yeah. So, what about the Pinot Noir program? You didn't make Pinot. You didn't work with Pinot at all at Flora Springs, I don't think. Yeah.
No.
So back then, you really had no background in Pinot, but it sounds like you really had an interest in French wine and French culture.
Oh,
so
yes.
You were drawn to that.
Well, the break came when I became the winemaker at Honig Cellars. The Honigs specialized in Sauvignon Blanc, and the market for Sauvignon Blanc was okay, but
not
was
like
a,
what it is today.
Not,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was a bit of an uphill push, and so part of my contract with them was to begin custom crushing, and so it was a beautiful facility in the middle of Napa, and so I went out and found customers to come in and make wine at Honig Cellars, and so I got to make a couple of Pinot Noirs there, but really the issue with Pinot was finding the grapes. There was a strong movement for Chardonnay on good soils, but at the time, in the late 80s and early 90s, Pinot Noir was really not well-respected, not being planted anywhere to speak of except for Champagne Cuvée, some obviously in Russian River, and we started going over to Russian River in the early 90s, and there were just no grapes. It was just plain and simple. A question of supply. And so we looked for almost 3 years before we found a vineyard that we liked enough and that had the correct soils and clones. And that's right when the Dijon clones were being introduced. And so it was just the beginning of the Sonoma Pinot Noir scene. And that's really what got us into Pinot in 95, was the fact that there were Dijon selection vineyards that were being planted by real quality-minded growers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it took us, you know, a long time to find those vineyards, and even longer to find somebody that was willing to grow them properly.
You know, I want to talk more about Pinot. I'm gonna try to get you to talk you into sticking around for the third segment after 2:30. And I want to talk about Pinots, but let's get back to Chardonnay for a second. It seems to me, and I could be wrong, because like I said, I was aware of Pats and Hall wines, but I wasn't really on top of Pats and Hall wines. It seemed to me that your Chardonnay style has changed a little bit in recent vintages. They used to be bigger in style. They used to be a little more fruity and in your face. And it seems to me now you have a little more minerality. Maybe, you know, am I off base with that assessment?
No, I think you are correct, Robert. First, there's been
What prompted that?
Well, it was somewhat of a change in style as one element. I began to work with, you know, vineyards that had higher acid was another element. Some subtle winemaking changes. We whole cluster press our grapes, and I started to take larger press fractions starting about 6 years ago. We used to press the grapes harder. And then after a couple of visits to France, tasting through some trials, I came back and started doing some trials with the pressures in the press. And so we're pressing the grapes less hard than we used to.
Mm-hmm.
The other is better barrels. Almost 5 years ago, I started buying my own oak in Burgundy and aging it at Francois Frere. So instead of buying a complete barrel from Francois Frere, we buy the oak as it's cut down in the forest and then age it for 3 years. A typical barrel stave wood is aged in the elements seasoned more or less for 18 mm-hmm. months. And so this is double the seasoning length. And that adds a real elegant, more nuanced oak component to the wine,
mm-hmm.
which then allows, I think, a little more expression from the vineyard and less of that sort of oaky, heavy quality. And so it's really been an evolution.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's my impression that if you're a little clumsy with the oak, you kind of mask the characteristics
exactly.
that come from the vineyard. And it seems to me, and not just with your Pats and Hall Chardonnays, but with Nickel and Nickel, with their vineyard-designated mm-hmm. shards, and Sonoma-Cutrer's Le Pierre, there's a tremendous respect now for the terroir, for minerality, for the acid balance
yes.
in the wine. And you know, I love those kinds of wines. And I was kind of down on California Chardonnay for a while, which could be one of the reasons that I didn't pay as much attention to Pats and Hall then as I do now, because I have fallen in love with Chardonnay all over again, California Chardonnay in particular. And I think it's because there has been a shift in style that's
right.
very perceptible.
Yes, I'm certainly seeing that amongst my peers. I think there's been a movement towards this for some time, and it's really gratifying to see that it's being appreciated
mm-hmm.
as well. You know, 10 years ago, there was size was a big issue, you know, making the wines bigger, more dramatic, more powerful. And I think there has been a movement away from that to something that emphasizes more elegance and nuanced flavors, more of sense of place as opposed to just, you know, raw
mm-hmm.
horsepower.
Although I will throw out this caveat. I think there still is a place for the oily type of Chardonnay. And there are some areas where that's what you get. Those are the grapes that the vineyard gives you.
Well, we have a couple of those, too.
You know, I mean, look
we make eight Chardonnays, so
yeah,
we cover the bases.
You look at Sleepy Hollow, for example, down in Monterey County, that vineyard is going to give you a big, rich, oily Chardonnay. It's nothing you can do, but the acidity is great, too. So it makes a nice wine, but it's a bigger wine than what we've been talking about. And then you have I believe it's your Napa Valley, where you blend some Carneros fruit with a little riper, richer, rounder fruit. And so you get a nice balance there. You get some of that oiliness, but you
mm-hmm.
also get some of that that bright acidity that comes out of the Carneros area.
It's a combination of Hyde vineyards
mm-hmm.
And Antinori vineyards, which is on the top of Atlas Peak.
Atlas Peak, yeah, which I would imagine is a little warmer.
Well, actually,
even though it's in the south,
it's you would think it's warmer because it's up high. But this one vineyard has an exposure to the south. and it is one of the coldest vineyards in Napa.
Oh, you're kidding.
We pick that vineyard later than most of our Russian River fruit. It's really an interesting microclimate up there, and it does really well with Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
The Ansonori family is preparing to take that vineyard back from Atlas Peak Winery, and they're going to be making some Chardonnay under their Antica brand. It's just fabulous.
Now, how do you find your vineyard sources? Do people come to you?
Some. I'm creative about this. You meet people, you talk about their vineyards, you taste other people's wines. Of course, that's one way.
Mm-hmm.
The other is, new vineyards, people that want to get into the business, want to try to create a relationship with a winery that can help them define the quality they have. So a lot of new vineyard owners contact me. But really, I would say about 1 in 10 actually make the cut. We have a beautiful portfolio of wines now, and frankly, the track is very fast. And so to make a new single vineyard wine is a major commitment on our part, and we really have to see eye to eye in the vineyard. And, of course, the vineyard has to be very special as well. So it's happening less and less in the recent days.
Yeah. When you're as engulfed in a, I'll say engulfed, that's probably the wrong choice of words, in a vineyard-designated wine program as you are, you're making very small lots of everything.
Yes.
Does that present you a big challenge?
Well, there's, more details, but really it's made one barrel at a time. And if you lose track of the individual barrel, then a lot of things slip through the cracks. And so when we first started, we, were focused on barrel-by-barrel winemaking, and that hasn't changed. It's, it's a lot of work, but, hey, I love it. So
yeah, and the result, as they say, is in the bottle. They're really good. We're going to have to take a break now, but when we come back on the other side with James Hall, we're going to discuss their Pinot Noirs.
Save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice. Talk to me nice, you've got to wind me.